the cost of the salmon, we be able to understand the teaching of all Buddhas, the Four Noble Truths. May we be able to embark on the path to our liberation. May we be able to break free from the four hells once and for all by achieving the noble state of Sotapanna. And for those among you who may have already achieved that noble state, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill the subsequent stages and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. With that resolve in mind, I invite you all to prepare yourselves to listen to this sermon. You know that in all our sermons, one of the first things we do, which is part of the preamble, is to invite the deities as well as other sentient beings who may be invisible to the naked eye, but we know from our understanding of the Dhamma still do exist. And they, just as much as all of us, you, are beings who are looking for a chance to break free. I hope when we make that invitation at the start of these sermons, at the start of practically any sermon, it is not just the monks here, but it is a tradition. A tradition with deep meaning. And with a great significance. I hope that when you all join in on a sermon, you also take a moment to make that invitation. I agree that among you will be those who are superstitious, as well as those who may be skeptics, those who may question the presence of such beings. How can you say these deities, these gods, these demigods, these semigods, all these beings, how can you say they exist when I've never seen one? This is all superstition. It's all made up stuff. Some of you may feel that way. Others may have some belief in them. And more others who, as they progress on the Dhamma and realize the workings of the mind, realize in more depth and more breadth the workings of the Dhamma, the dependent origination process, how the whole system hangs together, how it is the sankharas that give rise to various forms of existence, you will most certainly realize with conviction that they certainly do exist. So I suppose one way of checking your understanding of the Dhamma as you go forwards on this path is perhaps, now this is not a complete test as such, this is not the only way that one can check oneself, but I would like to propose that as you work your way through the Dhamma, as you begin to realize the workings of the mind, as you begin to realize how where there is ignorance and attachment, where there is room for abhisankara, how the forms that come into existence take the shape of those abhisankaras, the more you begin to realize this, the more you will begin to accept the possible existence of such beings. Now I am possibly the best example for this. I am one of the biggest skeptics I've ever known. I refuted all claims of the existence of such beings in my early years, as I had taken refuge in science and technology, with little regard for anything that may exist, with little regard for those who have gone forth, those who have understood the ways of the world, have seen the world in ways that I was never able to, with little regard for them and what they had to say, I was very quick to dismiss any claims of their existence. Because back then I thought I knew it all, and back then I thought those who speak of the existence of such beings are those who are ignorant, are the fools. Why would you say something exists when you can't see it with your own two eyes? As I have progressed on the Dhamma, on the path of the Dhamma, and have begun to understand how all this fits together, how, for instance, there isn't even a personal identity here within this mind and body, and simply a process that keeps running endlessly, with a flaw in the process that keeps spawning suffering. The more I begin to understand this, the more my horizons begin to broaden, and the more I begin to realize how wrong I was. So as I suggested, one of the ways you can check yourself, one of the ways you can check yourself and your understanding of the Dhamma is how willing you are to accept that there are such beings that don't meet the eye. There are beings out there who are not all flesh and blood, who you may not be able to see, in the various realms of existence, the more your understanding of the Dhamma, the less reluctant you will be to accept their existence. Because a lot of the time we get such questions, both types of questions. Do they really exist? As much as, how do I check how much I have understood the Dhamma? So the answer to the second is the answer to the first question, with what I'm suggesting here. Now don't take this as the one and only way of checking your understanding. It is certainly not. Your experience of how less you suffer compared to how much you used to should always be your acid test of how much and how well you are progressing on the Dhamma. But what I'm suggesting and what I'm offering you to you is also is another check that you can do, a supplementary check if you like. This is not the be-all and end-all of it, but this is a supplementary check. This will complement. You can use this as a way to test how much you have understanding, how much of an understanding you have on the process, on the master process that beautifully executes existence. Because at the end of the day, existence is a process that has been crafted most skillfully with perfection. Well, except for one flaw. Perhaps you are wondering what that flaw might be. I will explain to you today. Listen on and you will learn. But what I'm saying is, as we make a start to our conversation, ask yourself how willing you may be to accept the existence. Even if you don't accept, at least to not reject the idea entirely that such beings may exist. I can say this for myself because I, for one, was someone who categorically rejected no ifs, no buts. It is not possible that they exist was my stance a while ago. A long while ago now. But I certainly was in that camp. I completely rejected the idea. And even when I used to attend a sermon and I would hear the Swami Mohan says, make that invitation, I would sometimes jest about it. And I'd think to myself, why are they wasting their time? Why are they wasting my time? What a worthless, useless thing to be doing. Every day they invite them, but no one comes. So what's the point? Besides, you keep inviting and no one's coming, so why bother? These are some of the thoughts that I had in my mind when I was perfectly blinded by ignorance. But as I say, folks, as we make progress in the Dhamma, those ideas, those opinions which we hold on to so strongly and fight to prove his right so fiercely, they start to fall by the wayside as you begin to realize what a fool you have been, how ignorant you have been. So that's one way to check That's one way to test how much your understanding of the Dhamma has progressed. Because the more you are steadfast on the idea that what exists can only be that which can be observed through the five senses and nothing else can exist, the more you hold on to that idea, the less you have understood the Dhamma, the workings of the Dhamma. I can't think of an Arahant who completely rejects the idea of the existence of Devas. In fact, leave alone an Arahant, I can't think of a Sotapanna who completely and entirely rejects the idea of Devas, Brahmas, demons, spirits, and the like. I feel it's impossible to both be a Sotapanna and to completely reject the idea that these beings who are invisible to the eye exist. Personally, I feel that's impossible. In fact, that's one of the Dasavastuka Mithyadhisti, or the 10 things that one has wrong view about. Nati Satta Opapatika. Beings who arise spontaneously do not exist. That is one of the ideas, wrong ideas, that are shed by one who moves forward from worldly wrong view, or from worldly wrong view to worldly right view, which is Laukika Mithyaditti to Laukika Sammaditti. And that is, it is upon that point they move from Laukika Sammaditti to Lokottara Sammaditti. So that's what I say, I find it just doesn't make sense how someone can understand that the whole thing hangs together through a process of dependent origination. Ignorance and attachment are the roots of all forms of existence, and all things created take the shape of Abhisankara. How someone can accept that and not accept, or rather completely reject, the existence of Devas and Brahmas and spirits and demons? The two things cannot happen together. They are mutually exclusive. So if you accept one, then you have to accept the other. If you accept that dependent origination explains the workings of the world, it explains the way things work and operate, it explains how beings exist and how they come into being, how they pass away, how suffering comes into existence, and all the rest of it. One who accepts that, one who acknowledges that, how they can completely reject the idea or the existence of spontaneous beings, I struggle to understand that. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think that can be the case. So that is why I'd like to propose to you that if your mentality is one which entirely rejects the idea of devas, pretas, and other beings in the four great hells. Of course, you'll accept the animal world because that is observable to the five senses. But beings in the other four worlds of the four great hells, or the other three worlds of the four great hells, if you are someone who completely rejects the idea, I'd say take some more time to study the Dhamma, understand it, before you self-proclaim to be a Sotapanna. As far as I'm concerned, the two can't coexist. You can't reject the idea of the spontaneous beings and claim to be a Sotapanna. I say this because through the Dhamma, it becomes evident that the existence of such beings is plausible. It is perfectly possible that such beings may exist. And for that, you don't need empirical evidence. You don't need to see beams of light, or shooting stars, or UFOs, or anything of the like, to believe that those beings exist. I used to be so foolish to ask those teachers who taught me that such beings exist, well, if they do, then show me. Where are they? I used to be so foolish to ask that question, and the truth of the matter is, when I did ask that question once or twice, the answer I got back is, one day you shall realize. And how true they were. They didn't say, one day you shall see. They said, one day you shall realize. So, why am I talking about this? I like to propose to you ways and means in which you can gauge yourself on this journey. There are many other ways you can test yourself, like how good a husband or how good a father, how good an employee you are to your organization, to your family. Are you a Kalyana Mitra to your friends? How duty-bound you feel to others, how you feel about all other sentient beings, whether you feel compassionate towards them. Have you started to shed the Vasala Gati? These are, of course, ways that you can test yourself. And we have spoken this on many an occasion. In fact, those are the ways we always ask you to check yourself. Now, I have always reserved myself from talking about this topic, particularly in our English sermons, because I have always felt that a primarily English-speaking audience who may be influenced by Western thinking, the likes of myself included, and if you are anything like me, will at first completely reject the existence of anything that doesn't meet the eye. That's just the way we are. We then begin to listen to the Dhamma. We first begin to understand the world around us. And the more you understand the Dhamma, the world around us, the world around you starts to reduce in size. Your focal length reduces. You start dropping that old telescope and start picking up the microscope, and you start becoming more of an introvert in this context, I mean. more than an extrovert, and you start to look at yourself. And the more you understand yourself, the more you understand how the Dhamma works. And then there comes a point in your realization whereby you begin to understand, actually, there is no self here at all. This is just a process. So much so that you begin to say, I am a process. And you do say, I am, just for convenience. That's just a convention. For the purpose of convention, for the purpose of convenience, you'll say, I am, whereas all you want to say really is process. This is a process. So if this is a process, then this process can explain all things that have come into being. And then you begin to realize this process is able to bring about the formation of various things, of various form, of various shapes and sizes. It does not say anywhere that those things have to be visible to the human eye. They have to be in the visible spectrum of the human eye. Where does it say in the Paticchasamuppada that anything that comes into being is always within the visible spectrum of the human eye? Some of you will understand what it is I'm saying. Others may struggle. Others may see a glimpse of hope in what I'm saying. A glimpse of, actually, what Swaminathan says is possibly agreeable. But others may even completely reject what I'm saying right now. And for those of you, what I have to say is, wait, and one day you shall realize. But as I often remind my parents when I get a chance to talk to them, there are some things in this world which are better to accept and at least be open-minded to. Let us not go as far as saying accept, but being open-minded to, and to conduct ourselves by working on the hypothesis that the aforementioned is true. Because if we don't, then the cost of neglecting it and completely rejecting it is too large, is too great. What do I mean by that? Say, for instance, someone rejects the existence or the idea of the four great hells. And therefore, their actions are not disciplined, and they believe that I can conduct myself in any way. Why do I care if my words hurt someone? If my actions cause pain to others? Why do I care? Because this is going to be it. You know, I'm a materialist. When this body dies, that's me, I'm dead. And it cannot be that the hells exist. Now, that's all good and well, but the problem is, what if it does? The problem is, if it does, and you reject the idea, then you've got a lot to lose. Whereas on the other hand, if you don't reject it, and the hells don't exist, but because your belief is that they do exist, you are careful in your actions, in your words, in your thoughts, and you work to rid yourself of the defilements. Now, what harm has been done? What have you lost? you know, whether the hells exist or not, right? Whenever you engage in something that is unmeritorious, how do you feel on the inside? Does anger and hatred burn you only because the Buddha said so? Had he forgotten to mention that, he wouldn't have been so torturous on the inside when you get angry? Have you ever looked at yourself in the mirror when you're angry? It's one thing you can do. When you're angry, if you can come to your senses, try taking a walk, walk in front of the mirror and have a look in there. See what you look like. What you see in the mirror. The mirror, mirror on the wall will say a lot about you. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the angriest of them all? Even when you're not angry, just go stand in front of the mirror and frown. Look in the mirror and frown to yourself. You know, like when you are angry. At all those bodily expressions of anger. Right? The wrinkled forehead, clenched fists. Look at yourself in the mirror. Do you like what you see? Is that one of your best looks? So if that's what's happening on the outside when you're angry, imagine what's happening on the inside. After all, the face is the mirror to the heart, isn't it? If the thoughts that pass through your mind can do that to your physical appearance, imagine what it does to itself on the inside. Right? That's what anger can do to you. That's what anger does to you. So, do you necessarily need to believe in the after effects of anger? In the fact that that can lead to birth in the hells? You've got the results then and there. You can see what it does to you then and there. It burns you on the inside. So what it does to the mind, what the mind does to itself, or what anger does to the mind, what aversion does to the mind. In fact, you're only seeing a small portion of that when you look at yourself in the mirror. So coming back to what we were talking about, the existence of the hells, the existence of the heavens, both realms which are invisible to the naked eye, you will be more willing to accept, more willing to acknowledge. The more you understand the Dhamma. I can only see it working that way. As I said, I can't think of a sotapanna who completely rejects the idea of hells and heavens. Not because the Buddha's talked about wrong view and the 10 things that one holds in wrong view. Not because the Buddha said so. But because for one to become a sotapanna, they must at least begin to realize that what's going on here is a process. They must have moved away from the self-view. We have spoken about this as Sakkaya Ditti. That what's in operation here is a process rather than a self. So if it's a process, and ignorance and attachment, ignorance is the forerunner of this process, and attachment, the hijacker of this process. And Abhisankara, which is the creator, the architect, which orchestrates the entire system, then the arising of beings which are invisible to the naked eye is entirely possible. You see, the problem is, people who reject the idea is that they look at it from the tail end of the process. So there's a production line, and you are sat at the end of the production line. And you're looking at the goods, the products that come out at the end of the production line, with no knowledge, with no insight as to how the thing works on the inside, because it's all covered up. All you see are the end products. If that is all that is visible to you, then really the only things you'll see are the goods that come to you on the conveyor belt. But there will be those along the length of the conveyor belt, there will be those products which will be rerouted to other areas, and that you don't see because you're at one end of the production line. Whereas if you trace your steps back along the production line, you will come across the other diversions, the other detours. And if you walk all the way back to its source, and you realize that this is simply a process, there's no one doing anything here, there are some raw materials going in, and some products coming from the outside, coming in, coming out on the outside, and you look at the process right from the start of it, right from where the whole thing begins, then you begin to realize anything is possible. Now, if you're struggling to absorb and acknowledge or accept this idea, then don't worry too much. I have always tried to focus our sermons on that which you can accept through logic and reasoning, and I assure you, what I have spoken about just now is also acceptable through logic and reasoning, but it depends on where you are, on your ability to logic and reason, and where you are on your understanding of the Dhamma. So if you're still struggling to accept the idea, it may be that perhaps as we start the sermon and we do the invitation to the gods, perhaps that's a moment when you remain silent. There may be the odd person that remains silent because they don't believe in that stuff. I use the word stuff because there's another word and it's too offensive, so I'm not going to use that. I don't believe in that. You know the word. So if you rank among them, I'm saying it's okay. It's okay. Wait, and you shall realize. One day you shall realize. You don't need to go and do any other experiments. Some people do a lot of work. They really do struggle and try really hard to go and see gods, and they go into the devalas and all places, all sorts of places, and they work on black magic and various other Ouija boards and, you know, various other things people do to look at spirits and gods and demons and to communicate with them. All I'm saying is, wait and you will realize. You don't need to try and struggle so hard. One day when you begin to understand the workings of the Dhamma, as I'm trying to explain to you here, you'll begin to realize that anything is possible. In fact, you'll begin to realize that all sorts of new species can be born in future. Because if it is the Abhisankara that gives form, that gives birth to various forms, then all sorts of new species can be born in future. It is said that a very small number of species have yet been found by scientists. One reason that I feel this is true is that all sorts of species continue to come into existence. New species continue to come into existence. Now this is only my take on this, so don't ask where in the Tripitaka this is said. This is my take on it. Because of sankharas, all sorts of new beings, new species come into existence. So therefore, no matter how much you discover a new species, more species continue to come into existence. More species continue to be born. And scientists will say that some species have become extinct. The only thing that can actually become extinct is the mind of an arahant as it enters into parinibbana. The way I understand the word extinction, that is the only context in which you can talk about extinction. As the causes for anything to come into being have ceased to exist, from that point forward, nothing can exist. And hence existence, or rather extinction. So, the way I understand it, the way I read it, the way it's become, I like to say, obvious to me, is extinction can only be talked about in the context of the mind of an arahant. This side of the fence, those beings that scientists are really having a tough time, and environmentalists who try to preserve those beings going into extinction, if they were to talk to me, a simple answer I have to say to them is, don't worry, they'll come back again. Because think about it. An animal dies, and then we understand that there are beings who exist but unseen to the human eye. So let us call them the Gandhabas for now. Any beings with flesh and bones, a body with flesh and bones and blood, will take the shape of a Gandhabha. How can they go into extinction unless an animal has somehow become an arahant? The body has passed away, the body has died, has been destroyed, but the mind has moved on and taken the shape of a Gandhabha again. The environment doesn't exist in the human world for such a body to be recreated, and therefore we don't see those creatures among us today. That is what scientists refer to as extinction. But if you ask me, none of those species have really gone into extinction. How can you say, Swami Nuhansa? Wait, and you shall realize. Prove it? I've got no time for that. Because if you want proof, the proof is in what I'm saying to you right now. That is the proof. The Dhamma is the proof. The process of dependent origination is the proof. The only way to extinction is to uproot all causes for existence. To rid all causes for existence, and now you can talk about extinction. Where greed or desire, aversion and delusion, and non-desire, non-aversion and non-delusion, lobha dosa moha and alobha dosa amoha, the six causes, the six primary causes which bring about existence, once all those six causes have been extinguished, now we can talk about extinction. Because now there are no causes for anything to come into being. Isn't that when extinction can actually be a valid term? I read somewhere the other day, if I remember it right, as many as two or so species become extinct every single day. That might send a shockwave down the spines of environmentalists and biologists. But what I have to suggest is, don't fear. Of course, continue to work on the environment and making sure that, you know, it's a green earth and all the rest of it. Don't have to stop with that. What I'm saying is, once the environment is ready for them to reappear, they will reappear because they haven't really gone into extinction. So again, my point here is, now it may be you reject all these ideas. And perhaps you don't even like to call yourself a skeptic. Wait and you shall realize. The more you understand the principles, the doctrines of anicca, dependent origination, the more you'll realize that really anything is possible. Because there's no doer, so there's no one to control the process. There's no one to rectify any flaws in the process. There's no one to pull the handbrake on the process. Oh no, not that way, the other way. There's no one to do that. There is no overseer of the process. It's just a process. Why do we talk about the process? My intention of talking about the process is not to somehow convince you that gods and pretas and those beings who are invisible to the naked eye actually do exist. That is not my intention. That is not my purpose. My intention is to somehow help you understand that one, suffering is entirely a product of a process. You'll remember when I first introduced the idea of dependent origination, I asked you to fill the word, the two words, dependent origination. I asked you to put some words in between those two key words to sandwich it with suffering. Do you recall that? When we talked about dependent origination, I told you, actually you need to put in a few extra words. And when I say dependent origination, you got to think in your minds, the dependent origination of suffering. We spoke about this long time ago. Because it is the origination or the dependent origination of suffering, which the Buddha explains to us. He, of course, was able to realize, he, of course, understood how all sentient beings come into existence. Because his understanding knows no bounds. His understanding is perfect. He is the omniscient one, so he understands literally everything. If there is anything to be understood, he understands it. And whatever he understands is all there is to understand. So you can take it both ways. Whatever there is to realize, he has realized. And whatever he has realized is all there is to realize. Whatever he has seen is all there is to be seen. And whatever there is to be seen, he has seen. I think you understand what I mean by those words. So he is the omniscient one. Now, his intention as the Buddha was not to make us all omniscient ones. Because he realized how tough and difficult and arduous that is. If anything, once he became the Buddha, that is probably when he probably asked himself, why did I not take the shortcut when I had the opportunity at the feet of the Lord Deepankara? He probably asked himself that question the moment he became the Buddha. Well, perhaps he didn't. How can I comment on that? Perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't. But either way, his intention was not to help us all become Buddhas. If that were the case, he wouldn't have preached the Dhamma. His intention was for us to free ourselves, was to help us free ourselves, help us liberate ourselves. And for that, all we need to use the dependent origination system, the process, is to understand how suffering comes into being. That is why whenever we talk about dependent origination, perhaps when two Buddhas meet each other and they talk about dependent origination, they speak in terms of the dependent origination of everything. But when you and I get together, we talk about the dependent origination of suffering, which is just one of the things from that pool of everything. We don't need the rest because we have a bigger problem on our hands. The dependent origination of suffering. This doctrine was put forward by the Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings like you and I, to understand that we ourselves are responsible on our own for the coming into being of suffering. Suffering is causal. The causation of suffering, the mind has to be responsible for, and no one else. It is based in ignorance, and its cause is attachment. Based in ignorance and caused by attachment, suffering comes into being. That is the teaching of the Buddhas. And it is to understand that we must strive. Now, I mentioned right at the start of the sermon that this is a perfect system except for one flaw. So whoever the system architect was, unfortunately, there is a flaw in the system which becomes obvious to the perfect one. And the moment that becomes obvious to you, to oneself, then you become the perfect one, particularly if it's without help and assistance from others. But the moment the flaw becomes obvious to you, and then you escape, then you become an enlightened one. In fact, you have heard the word enlightenment even before you came across the Dhamma. Right? Enlightenment, if you look it up in the dictionary, it will have some, one of its meanings will have some base in Buddhism. But generally speaking, enlightenment will refer to becoming aware, becoming knowledgeable about something. That is what enlightenment is. As people say, enlighten me on this. That is, what they don't mean is, you know, make me an arahant. That's not what they mean when they say that. And you will have often used that word when you talk about various things. You know, you might be, you're giving a business presentation. And you say, today I'm going to enlighten you on this new product that we'd like to offer to our customers. Right, that's not the Noble Eightfold Path you're talking about. So you use the word enlighten in terms of making someone aware. Now, there's a real significance with that term. This is why I'm trying to show you something here. Really, enlightenment is becoming enlightened to the fact, or becoming aware of the fact, that there is a loophole in this almost perfect system. So what is the flaw in this system? You'll be surprised to hear that it is something you have heard us mention many countless times. So much so that sometimes people disregard it because they hear it day in, day long, day in, day out, all day long. The flaw in the system is merit. Particularly merit when it moves towards altruism, which is where you think about others before you think about oneself. So that's what is meant by altruism. Others before oneself. That is the flaw in the system. How is that so? Let me explain. See, this perfect system, or this almost perfect system, has been designed by whom? That's the wrong question to be asking. It's a system. No one designed it. It's there. How can that be? I know, that's what your mind's grappling with right now. The reason for that is, you believe that you exist. You believe that you are the one who's doing all these things. And we are always so accustomed with having a doer. Right? All our sentences have to be in the active tense. It's what we have become used to. Because we always feel that there has to be a doer, there has to be someone who is doing all these things. But you recall from our previous sermons, we talked about this at some length, right? This is a process. We'll talk about it again in future. Step by step, we will make progress. So there's a system. There's a process. This is an almost perfect system. This is why, when a perfect one comes along, they immediately spot the flaw with the system. Because it's not a perfect system. Because if it were a perfect system, then a perfect one wouldn't find a flaw in the system. Would they? If someone's found a flaw in the system, then there cannot be a perfect system. It's like in science. You know, someone proposes a theory, and then by experimentation, or a hypothesis, and by experimentation you prove the hypothesis, and eventually it becomes a theory. But it only remains a theory until someone comes along and disproves the theory. And to do that, you only need how many examples? How many examples do you need? How many cases do you need to disprove a theory? You only need one. If you find one instance by which you can prove that the theory does not stand the test, then you have disproved the theory. And now you have opened up an avenue for scientists to continue their experimentation and to come up with new theories and new ways of thinking, right? So that is the way the science world works, and long may it continue to do so. Keeps people in jobs. Good. So, coming back to what point of discussion is, this system of how all things hang together, the system of how the entire universe operates, and by when I say the word universe, all these words have various connotations. Now that is one of the problems I have when I'm doing these sermons. Because when we say universe, the first thing that comes into mind is, so that's the nine planets and the sun and the solar system and Andromeda and all the other galaxies. You know, that big thing, that universe where we speak in light years. That is not what I mean by universe. What I mean by universe is everything that exists. So, whatever exists is what I hereby refer to as the universe. So don't think the big massive, galaxies and the black holes and all that stuff. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm simply talking about everything that exists. Your universe. Okay? The process that operates for this universe to exist has one flaw in it. Has one imperfection in it. And that flaw makes this process an imperfect process. So there's one link, which is brittle. Tap on it and it breaks. And like a chain, which is only as strong as its weakest link, the moment you find this link, is the moment you have broken free. Now, of course, to find that weak link, you need someone, again, by someone, now you've got to take it in the context that someone exists, but someone doesn't really exist. This is a very multidimensional conversation, that is the problem. Well, you asked for it, so I'm giving it to you now. You have asked in your questions, Swami Nasa, please explain to us the things you're thinking about these days and how you're progressing in the path. So from time to time, I will share some of my thoughts with you. Now, something I feel, which I hope I'm not right in saying this. This sermon you'll probably listen to about 10 times over. But perhaps the previous sermons, whereby we talk about respecting your elders, being good husbands and good wives, and being a good student and being kind and generous to everyone, perhaps that not so many times. But anyway, for your philosophical musings, as you have asked, I will share some of my thoughts. So coming back, so you must realize I'm jumping between dimensions here. When I talk about someone, I'm talking about someone in a conventional sense. Because I cannot talk about something that you don't know by using words that you also don't know. Right? That makes sense, right? It's like if a tortoise was to explain land to a fish, what is the point of using words like trees and mountains? The fish wouldn't understand. So a tortoise would have to use words that a fish does understand, because those words are not in its vocabulary even, let alone have a sense of what they mean. So it's going to have to use words which the fish is aware of to explain this novel concept. And then eventually, step by step, perhaps the fish may one day get a glimpse of the world offshore, or on shore rather, and then begin to realize, now I see. That one glimpse is enough to accept with conviction that what the tortoise has been talking to me about this far is true. All that remains now for me to do is to realize that for myself. Right? So likewise, I'm trying to talk to you about a concept that you may be foreign to, but I have to use words that you are familiar with. Hopefully that is obvious. So I'm talking about a system which orchestrates the entire operation of the universe. So this is how everything exists. And for your purpose, how suffering comes into being, it's an almost perfect system. Because it's an almost perfect system, an almost perfect one would not be able to spot the flaw with it. Hence you need the perfect one. So the perfect one is always one better than the system. Does that make sense? The perfect one is always one better than the system. One day I'll explain to you that it is by the system itself that the perfect one is also made. But we'll leave that for later. It is for the balance of the system. It's for equilibrium. Because without a Buddha, this whole system would go into imbalance. But too many Buddhas, and again the system would go into imbalance. We are talking about a system that exists forever. It has existed forever. And it will exist forever. So there is something that exists forever. Come back. Put your ground back on the feet. Rather, put your feet back on the ground. And, right? So reel yourself back in. Reel yourself back in. Let's not go there. Right? One step at a time. Suffering exists. And the system that brings suffering into existence exists. There is no someone that exists. Never did, never, not today, and never will. But a system exists. And in this system, there is a flaw, and that flaw is altruism. Merit done with altruism in mind, which is to think of others before one thinks of oneself, or put others beyond oneself. This is why we have been talking to you about this all along. Always do more for others than you do for yourself. Put others first. Always let others have the opportunity. Put yourself second. Give others the chance. That's an anomaly with the system. For those who may be familiar with computer programming, that's an unhandled error, exception. It has not been coded how that error, if one hits that error, how it is to be. And that is what a Bodhisattva did. I think about how the Bodhisattva became a Buddha, for instance. Right? In each and every one of the Jataka stories, he always sacrificed himself, didn't he? Right? We learn about how he gave himself up, bloodshed and tears, or blood, sweat and tears, for the benefit of others. He always gave himself up for the good of others. He sacrificed himself. Anything and everything that he had, whenever he realized that someone else needs it more than he does, he always gave up. He gave them up. We remember from the Sasadhataka how it is told that he was born a rabbit. And there was a Sakadeva who took the form of a hermit. And on one occasion they wanted to make an offering. These animals, which included this rabbit who was the Bodhisattva on that occasion. Now I know the skeptics among you are thinking, what is he talking about? A rabbit making a sacrifice. Again, wait and you shall realize. So what did the rabbit do? To make an offering to this hermit, the rabbit jumped into the fire and offered itself. May you use this meat to sate your hunger, even if it means that I have to sacrifice myself. I will give myself up for you. See, that's a flaw in the system. The more you execute that code, that line of code, the more you follow that line of thinking, the sooner you find the exit out of this system. Now the opposite is also true. The more you focus your words, thoughts and actions, your conduct around yourself, the more you will remain a lifelong citizen of this system. That is how the system has been designed. That is why ignorance and mainly attachment keeps you bound to the system. Have you watched the movie Hunger Games? I remember it came out a few years before I ordained, so I still remember the story. How some young children, so teenagers, are put into this dome-like structure, and they are, so it's a game, really. So they have to live in this creation. So there's an architect who has built this stage, and they just go on living, and then the architect, along with his people, they control various elements of the environment in which they coexist, and well, the story goes from there. Much like that, folks, you know, sometimes I feel these people, the directors who come up with these stories, it's incredible how they can come up with some beautiful analogies. Perhaps they have no understanding of the Dhamma. But now that we see things through the Dhamma, there's a story behind all of these things, and many of those films I used to watch have a real resemblance. They can really be used to relate somewhat in the Dhamma. So in that film, you'll recall that was the story. Right? Some children put into, or some young adults put into a dome-like structure. But they don't know that they are in this game until much later on. And there's an architect who controls the whole thing. So much like that, imagine there's a system. This is the game. You recall we mentioned a game long time ago in one of our sermons. If you don't like the game, then I said get the hell out. If you don't like it. Right, so in this game, there is an architect. Now that architect is not a person, but it's the system. So there is no person, there is no creator, but there is a creation. And that creation operates in accordance with the system. This is the process which orchestrates the going ons and the whereabouts and how all the interplay between each of the actors in this game. And you and I are all actors in this game. Survival, or the instinct for survival, has been placed into each of these players. Now, if you've watched that movie, you can try and connect some of the dots and you'll be able to see the resemblance here. Instinct for survival. Once you put the instinct for survival into the minds of these beings, okay, now they will fight for their survival at any cost. And that instinct for survival is rooted in attachment. Because attachment, after all, is a strong need, a strong force that operates on the inside to protect oneself from everything else. I before everyone else. So that's self before others. Because when there's attachment, there is always a self that comes into creation, comes into being. And when there's a self, now that self requires self-protection. Aren't there a lot of words that have come into use today that start with self? A lot of words we use today, the whole world is centered on self, right? Self-preservation, self-confidence, self-assertion. A lot of self words. Selfish. All of that is rooted in attachment. Because once the bug, that is attachment, gets implanted in the mind, and the notion of a self comes into existence, now that self has to be protected at any cost. And when you do that, the more that happens, the more you become blind to the flaw in the system. One can't be selfish and altruistic at the same time. They are poles apart. You know, they're in fact the absolute opposites of each other. Whereas altruism is to think of others before you think of oneself, selfishness is to think about oneself, either before others or not to think about others at all, and just to think about oneself. The more one becomes selfish, the more one becomes self-centered, the more this system works flawlessly. I really want you to be able to imagine this, and for those of you who will have watched that film, it'll probably be easier. Imagine when those children were put into that dome, they were planted with some, and what they actually do in that story, if I remember right, is they forget who they are. Their memories have been erased. I know what you'll be doing this weekend. Anyway, so their memories have been erased and they don't know who they are. But fortunately, they all have an instinct to protect themselves. And with that instinct, so you know, what do I mean by an instinct? It's that feeling on the inside that I have to protect myself. In fact, it is probably the feeling of a self instinct. It's like a gut feeling that, you know, I am here and I have to protect myself at all costs, from all dangers, from all threats, for my survival. And if there's something to eat, then I have to make sure that I have my portion. You know, see, why am I relating this story? Because I want you to think about how you conducted yourself back then, and how, if you have been taken on our advice and guidance, how perhaps you have now changed. So the more you change, folks, the more you move towards this, the loophole in the system. The more you move towards the anomaly in the system, and then you, one day you're going to hit the anomaly. One day you're going to discover that. And the moment you discover that, then from then on, your route is in the direction of the exit. So, again, going back to the story, those children, their memories have been erased, but they have an instinct for self-defense. See, another self-word. All centered around this feeling that I exist, and for my existence, for my survival, I have to do all these things. They even talk about self-delusion. Isn't self the delusion? That's a really funny word, isn't it? Self-delusion? Or rather, self-deception? It's a funny word because deception, or rather, self is the deception. So that's deception, deception. I don't know why people talk about self-deception. See, this is the problem with this multidimensional world that we live in. People talk in two dimensions. In a two-dimensional world, I exist and everything around me exists, and I have to protect myself from the things around me. And to do that, there are some things I need to bring closer to me, and there are some things I need to move away from me. So that's in a two-dimensional world. Once you move away from that dimension, that's what I refer to as a paradigm shift. When you move away from that two-dimensional world, when you go through that paradigm shift and you start seeing the world from a third dimension, you begin to realize that this sensation, this feeling of a self, in fact, is the delusion. That is the deception. That is the biggest deception. One who is deceived talks about, says, I don't like to be deceived. Can you see the irony in that? So, with this feeling of, with this instinct to preserve oneself, one fights for one's survival. And the more one does that, the more they are actually playing the role that they are supposed to be playing in that game. Now, I have a very faint memory of the movie, but perhaps some of you will have a more vivid memory of it. If I remember right, in that story, there's a girl who actually wants to save her and everyone else from this deception. So she's not only concerned about her safety and well-being, but also that of others. She, of course, must care about herself because she's also in the system, because unless you help someone else out, but at the same time, again, if I remember right, she becomes the biggest headache for the architect. And then she starts a revolution. And then there's a huge uprising, and the whole thing starts falling apart. I have a very vague memory of how I think she shoots an arrow up into the sky and it hits one of the cells in the dome. And all of a sudden she realizes she had a faint idea. She had a guess. And that she went on a hunch, and that was confirmed when the arrow hit what she thought she was shooting at the sky, but in fact it went and hit one of the cells of the dome, and then the light went off, and then that cell went dark, and that's when the realization occurred. So she was doing that not only for herself but also for others. See, that is the flaw in the system. The moment you put others before yourself, the moment you start thinking about others and the good of others before oneself, the system cannot bear that. Because the system is not designed to sustain that sort of behavior. As far as the system is concerned, that's bad behavior. The long and the short of the story is you have no idea how much merit is the only answer to your salvation. Particularly merit whereby you put others ahead of you. So that's the moral of the story. Always put others ahead of you. Put others before you. A bit of self-sacrifice goes a long way. And the more you work towards self-preservation, the more you work towards protecting yourself and your needs and your wants, the more you will be a lifelong member of this game. And then freedom is only a fantasy. Excuse me. So the flaw in the system is altruistic merit. Now again, going back to the Bodhisattva, what did the Bodhisattva do? In the countless births that he endured, or an infinitely long journey in samsara, what did he do in each of those births? In his last birth as the Vetsantara, take a moment to remind yourself, what did he do? He gave up his children again to a hermit. He put others ahead of himself. Ultimately, he gave up his spouse. He gave up everything. He was a king. He gave up his kingdom. He gave up all his belongings. On all these occasions, we see how the Bodhisattva put others ahead of himself. The system has not been coded to handle that kind of behavior. That is an unhandled exception. That throws a fatal error. Because when you put others ahead of oneself, folks, what happens is this self diminishes. It begins to reduce in size. Now I'm speaking metaphorically. It begins to reduce in size. So if self were a ball, the more you put others ahead of yourself, it reduces in size, gets smaller. At first it's difficult, because you have to fight the urge. Now, if most of what today's sermon is sounds gibberish, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Take away the moral of the story. There's always a takeaway for you. It's fine if you don't understand the inner workings of all this. Now, just because you don't understand how all the capacitors and the transistors and the resistors work in the inside television doesn't mean you don't take one home and plug it in and start watching TV. Right? So, all you want is the end product. So, I'm talking to you about the inner workings of it because you asked. I know you'll never ask again. But what I'm trying to explain to you is, for those of you who can follow what I'm trying to explain to you here, is why I have been talking to you about the difficult stuff. Remember the difficult stuff? The stuff that arahants are made of. The kind of behaviors that Dasahandra has been talking to you about. Those role models. The kind of stuff that they're made of. That strength of character, that vigor, that determination, that resolve to always put others ahead of oneself. That self-sacrifice for the good of others. That willingness to do anything if it serves others. Remember the time once when the Bodhisattva was ever so hungry and he finally managed to find something to eat. And having consumed that, he realized there was an animal alongside. I think it was a female dog who was trying to feed its little pups and she was hungry. So she couldn't feed her little pups. And what did the Bodhisattva do? Induced vomit. So he went hungry and offered that as food to the poor animal. Again, what did he do on that occasion? Others before oneself. I can be hungry, but I can't stand you being hungry. What a beautiful way to live. What a great motto to shape one's life around, others before self. As I'm saying, folks, you don't need to understand the inner workings of this. The only reason I'm explaining this to you is because you're curious. But the things that we say, that the advice we give, I hope you begin to understand, are not just words. This is not just stuff we think, you might as well try and help others. No, this is all based in logic, in reasoning, and the truth. Have that as your life's motto, others before self. Make your purpose of existence the benefit of others. I exist to serve others. I exist to serve others. Make that your motto. That is the moral of the story. That is the key takeaway. Even if you didn't understand one bit of all that technical detail and jargon that I just spewed at you, that's fine. Don't worry about all of that. 1 in 100 might understand that. Maybe 1 in 1,000. That's fine. Don't worry about that stuff. But this stuff you understand. The problem is where most people, when we give this advice, They want to know why. But why do I have to be like that? And then we explain. And then they don't understand it. And then they tell themselves, I don't understand it, so why should I be like that? As I said, this is what I have been trying to explain to my parents for some time now. I give them advice all the time, engage in as many merits as you possibly can, in as much merits as you can. Light the lamp, do the Buddha Puja, help people out, do as much good as you can, particularly putting yourself second. Put the donkey last and put everyone else ahead of you. And sometimes they ask me why. Why does that work? How does that work? For bad or good, unfortunately my father's a scientist. That's his problem. Used to be my problem. But in some funny roundabout way, it also was my blessing. Because I always analyzed things through science, but I suppose the way I worked was I was always willing and open to new ideas. And today, through science, I'm able to see the real science. And that has come through realization. As my teacher once said, wait, one day you shall realize. So true, those words. The flaw in the system, folks, is altruistic merit. It's not just any old merit. The flaw in the system is altruistic merit. Merit whereby you put others before yourself. So what's the difference? I'll give you a very, very simple example. And I want you to think along those lines. Say there's only one meal or one plate of food left. And there's two of you. Merit may be to go half and half. I'll take half, here's the other half, you can have. Have the other half. That's merit. Yes, that is merit. That merit is programmed into the system. That merit keeps you in the system. That merit gives you birth as in the Sugati worlds, as a human, as a deva. But what is altruistic merit? You offer the entire plate to the other person. Here you go. And when you do that, you don't say, I'm hungry, but here you go. That's not altruistic merit. That's probably worse than merit. Because there's an unsaid line in there. Although I'm offering this to you, I'm really expecting you to return it to me. Altruistic merit is where you offer that plate of food, just that one plate of food to the other person. Here you go. You can have it. If they offer half to you, that's fine. Take it. You don't have to say, no, I'm doing altruistic merits now, no. You have to take this all. I'm going to go hungry. That's not what I mean here. Of course, this always has to be practical. Like we are very much people grounded on planet Earth, right? So we always look for answers very practically, very practical answers, very pragmatic answers. See how many merits you can think of, which perhaps if you just fine-tuned it just a little bit more, you can make it a little bit more altruistic than it currently is. Going half and half, I say, is merit, but that keeps you in the system. To break out of the system, you have to be one better than that. See, that's the secret no one tells you. Do you not recall, you know, in school and growing up, you learned if you go into the classroom and you have a friend who comes along and they don't have a pencil or a, well, not a pen, I suppose, a pencil to write with, what we learned was break your pencil in half and give one half to your friend and you use the other half. That is merit. Of course that's merit. Is it bad? No. That's good. That's so good. It will give you birth in probably the Paranimitta Vasavarti. That's how good that is. But that's also in the system. Aha. The 31 realms of existence are all nicely, neatly packed into the system. If you want to go beyond the 31 realms of existence, from existence to extinction, now then, you don't break the pencil in half. Because then, what you have offered him is a broken pencil. You give him the pencil. He may decide to break it in half and give you half. That's for him to decide. But you have given, not a little, not some, you have given all. You've given it all. The moment you do that, that line of code hits an exception. That path of execution hits an error. The system is not designed to handle that kind of behavior. Because you can't do that if what you're thinking about is the self. And self is a key component. Attachment is a key component for the existence and the survival of this system. This system is anchored on attachment and the self that is born out of it. When you're being selfless, the system can't bear that. That is why they say the path of Nibbana starts with dana or charity. Nibbana starts with charity. It starts with giving. Because when you give, what you give is a part of yourself. When you give, the whole system begins to shatter. The self, existence of the self and altruistic giving cannot both exist at the same time. It's like one and zero can't exist at the same time. It's got to be one or zero. So the more you give altruistically, the less of yourself you keep. I honestly don't know how much of what I'm trying to explain here is actually sinking with you folks, and I really don't know what to say. Do I continue or do I reel it back in? I'm lost just as much as you are. You're lost, right? Yeah, just as much as you are, I'm lost right now. Do I continue or do I reel it back in? Because, you know, normally I talk to you about what you need to do. What you need to be doing regardless of whether you understand the inner workings of it or not. But of course, when you start to ask the question, how, why, and how come it all works like that, well, then we have to open the Pandora's box. You asked for it. Now I've opened the bonnet. Before, you could just open the door, get into the car, turn the ignition, press on the accelerator, and the car would drive beautifully. But when you ask, how come when I press the accelerator, the car moves forward? Now you have asked the question. Then I have to ask you to get out of the car. See, that's the important bit. When I have to show you the bonnet, unfortunately, you're not in the car. And you're not moving any closer to your destination then, are you? Actually, I quite like that analogy. If you ask me to show you the bonnet, what's under the bonnet, to show you what's under the bonnet, I've got to ask you to get out of the car. You can only move forward when you're in the car. And you've got your foot on the pedal. But if you want to see under the bonnet, I have to ask you to get out of the car. And the moment you do that, now you're not moving forward. You're staying still. I can take you round to the front of the car, open the bonnet, and ask you to have a nice look in there. And I can explain to you how all the parts work together in perfect unison. How when the cogs turn of that wheel, it turns the other cog of this wheel, and how this belt turns that belt. I can explain all that. But are you moving any closer to your destination while I do the explaining? Look either side of you. Cars driving past you. Can you see that? What do you think they're doing right now? Looking under the bonnet or driving their car? This is why I try to restrain myself as much as I possibly can from explaining to you the inner workings of the Dhamma. One, it's difficult to understand. You need to be a mechanic to have a look under the bonnet and understand how all that hangs together and how the whole thing works. But you don't need to be a mechanic to drive a car. Hell, you don't even need a driver's license. I didn't have a driver's license when I first drove my car. Actually, cut that out of the sermon. But that's the way it works. That's how when you put your foot on the pedal, the car moves forward. You see now? So the moral of the story is just put your foot on the pedal and the car will move forward. Would you rather be driving your car or would you rather understand the engineering and how all the parts fit together? And the process. Because when you're looking at it, you're not moving any closer to your destination. Because you're out of the car. So my point being, folks, the anomaly of this system is altruistic merit. Particularly charity. When you give without thinking of yourself, without any concern for yourself, giving without concern for oneself, giving without keeping for oneself. Now again, please be practical when you do this. This is not to mean give up everything and go and live the life of a hermit tomorrow, you know, in a jungle, having given up all your your home and your clothes and everything, and, you know, walk in the forest with naked. That's not what I mean. Please be pragmatic. But what I mean is to move closer to that goal of Nibbana, which is the complete destruction of the sense of a self. You have to be altruistic. Altruistic giving starts the whole process. Because the system has not been designed, it has not been programmed to handle that kind of behavior. Think about the Suvi Siguna, the 24 great qualities. As I have mentioned in a sermon long time ago, I remember, we started to talk about them in some detail. The first of the 24, Anuttaram Punya Kettam, Lokasya. This is one of the great qualities of the Sangha. Or a Sangha Guna, one of the virtues, one of the qualities of the Sangha. You start by giving, by charity, by giving to the Sangha. That is not a person as such. The Sangha is a quality. It's a virtue that men and women around the world, like just like you and I, try to instill within ourselves. There is, of course, the conventional Sangha and the absolute Sangha. The conventional Sangha are the monks and nuns. But both they and lay people, like yourselves, are both attempting to instill the values of the Sangha so that we can all become absolute Sangha. That is the Attapurusa Puggala. Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho. Savaka Sangha. But of course you know that most of the time, if not all of the time, monks and nuns, they have dedicated their lives to instilling the values of Sangha within them. Therefore, they move forward on the path to becoming Sangha, to becoming Dhamma, and to becoming Buddha at a much faster rate than most others. And therefore, Anuttaram Punyakyata, an unequaled field to plant the seed. The plant the seed of what? Plant the seed of merit. By giving. That is why the Buddha established the Sangha. And that is probably one of the reasons why the Buddha established the Sangha. To help men and women just like you and I to kickstart our journey to Nibbana, because it starts with giving. And who better to give than the Sangha? Now I really need you to be intelligent as you listen to me talk about this particular point, because I am not saying this because I am part of the Sangha. Please don't read it that way. That would be very foolish. So what Swami Mahansa is saying is to give things to Swami Mahansa. No, that's not what I'm saying. This is the truth. What can I do? You know, imagine a king, right? He stands on a pedestal and he says, "My fellow men, from today onwards, I am your king." And a few fools somewhere in the audience says, "Oh, look at him, he says he's king." What can he do? He's the king. All he's saying is the truth. Yes, well, I am the king. What can I do? I am the king. It's something like that. So, you know, whether be that I am a monk, or even if it was that I was a clergy of another religion, even if I was a clergy of another religion, if I had the same understanding with which I speak to you now, folks, I would still say, give to the Sangha. Because what you give is a giving to the virtues of the Sangha. And chances are those virtues are more instilled in men and women who have dedicated their lives to developing and cultivating those values and virtues. And the moment you give, make that altruistic giving. Make that altruistic charity. And when you do that, you move a step forward on your way to hitting that imperfection in an otherwise perfect system. Because the power of the merits that you acquire, when you do that, that power is so, it has a lot of potency. It is so powerful that it pushes you forward on that journey. Again, I repeat, I'm not saying this because I'm a monk. Give to the Sangha because the Sangha is deserving of receiving. I'd say that even if I were a lay person, or even if I were a member of clergy of another religion, if I had the same understanding of the Dhamma as I do right now. If not, then of course I'd say something else. But today I realize why the Sangha, one of the qualities of the Sangha is Anuttaram Punya Kettam, Lokasya. Lokasya meaning to sentient beings, to worldly beings. The Sangha is an unequaled field for worldly beings to plant their seed of merit. That it is that seed of merit which one day shoots up as a sapling and then one day grows into a tree and then eventually bears the fruit of Nibbana. And as you do so, what is more, even more important is you become someone like that. See, that is the beauty of this. You know, I honestly have to say this. This is one of the most beautiful things I see about the Sambuddha Shasana. The meaning of these virtues, when you begin to study them, the more you understand them, the more you realize these are not just virtues that the Buddha explained to us and showed us so that we can make our venerations and show our respects to them, but also so that we could instill those virtues within ourselves. And then what does that make you? Eventually, does that not make you an Anuttara Punya Keta for other worldly beings? That is the way it works. The way it works in the Sambuddha Shasana is you help those ahead of you so that one day you get ahead, and then those behind you will help you get ahead, and then those behind them will help them get ahead, and then those behind them will help them get ahead, one after the other, in single file, they all move towards the goal of Nibbana. That is why giving charity is such an important thing to do. I'm showing you the loophole in the system. I'm at least trying to show you the loophole in the system. The loophole in the system is altruistic merit, or rather, to put it simply, altruism. Putting others ahead of oneself. Make that your life's motto. Others before me. Make your purpose of being alive on this earth the benefit of others, the betterment of others, the well-being of others, to help others. Make that your purpose of existence. It's a feeling I can't explain in words, I have to say, folks, really. It's not a feeling I can explain in words. But when you go through these motions, when you go through those emotions, and when you feel yourself as simply an entity that exists for the benefit of others, it's a really, that's the problem, I'm struggling to find the words to explain that. It's such a beautiful feeling. I'm feeling this way more so than I used to. And everyone I get to talk to, I advise and I help them to feel that way, to think about themselves in that way. Make your purpose of existence the benefit of others, the betterment of others, to help others move from good to great, to help others free themselves from suffering. And all the good things we have asked you to do previously, you know, if you understand at least some of what I have tried to explain to you today, you begin to realize the significance of that. Remember I said, when someone opens the door for you, it could be at the supermarket, thank them for it. They don't expect it from you, but thank them for it. To do that, you have to give up a part of yourself. Because it may be that it's an inconvenience, at least slightly, because you have to say something which you wouldn't otherwise. You have to exert an amount of energy for that. And it may be that everyone else who walked in before you said nothing. And they feel it is below them to speak in that way. To wish the good doorman good morning before, and rather than just to nod to them, to accept, to acknowledge their wish to you. People might feel that's just as below me. Why should I say good morning? I'm the customer. Customer is king. That's the problem. And have I not asked you to always thank others when they have done things for you, particularly when they don't expect it from you? Always thank them when you get an opportunity. It might be a simple phone call. It might be a letter. It might be a note, a thank you note. You're giving up a part of you every time you do that. It might be something as simple as a few rupees that you had to spend on a postage stamp to send a letter of compliments, to send a letter of thank you to someone who helped you. But even then you have given up a part of you for that. Think about who, you know, if you continue to work along these lines, think about the end product. Who is the Buddha? Or rather, what is the Buddha? Isn't the Buddha an entity that exists for the benefit, 100%, for the benefit of other sentient beings? Did the Buddha exist one day for his own good? Did the Buddha inhale one breath for his own good? When he realizes perfectly that having to breathe is an adversity that he has to endure so that he can exist in his physical sense, so that he can have a physical presence to help those around him. Buddhas wouldn't even breathe if that didn't help others around them. Arahants, they wouldn't even breathe if it didn't help others around them. Countless arahants they remained hungry. They forfeited their meals. They gave up in the time of the famine so that other monks could continue to survive, particularly those among the young monks, so that they could live on and spread the word of the Dhamma in the times of the famines. They starved themselves to death. Arahants. If it would help someone else, they'd starve themselves to death. If it would help someone, they would exhaust themselves to death. Because to them, death is nothing. That's the kind of stuff arahants are made of. And it all started with altruism. One day, they did something. Something which put others ahead of them. If you have been listening attentively to the stories that Dasa Amru has been sharing with you, you will have been able to spot those instances in each of those stories. How they gave up something and put themselves behind others, put others ahead of themselves. You remember Kisa Gotami? I'm just taking one example. How when she approached the man and his son, who used to be wealthy merchants, and they were at the market, and they had brought along their brickbac. It is said in the story that it was just pieces of ash, or rather coal, that they had brought along with them to sell. And one of their friends had said, you just have to be stood at the market, and one day a customer is going to come to you, and they'll touch the coal and it'll turn to gold. Do you remember that story? Kisa Gotami turned coal to gold. She did indeed. And I can hear the skeptics giggling, right, as if, no, you're taking the superficial meaning of that. There's a much deeper meaning behind it. You just need to switch on your intelligence. And then you'll begin to see. Then you'll realize, she did indeed turn coal to gold. What was cold? What was coal, rather? The coal was this brick and brack. Things that was left over. Because one day the merchant woke up and everything he had was taken away. I think it was burgled or something. They lost everything. But there were just some leftovers behind. Something of very little value. Things of very little value. Things that you would find in any household. Things that people wouldn't give a lot of value to. And that's what they gathered up and they took to the market. And they thought to themselves along the way, who's going to buy this stuff? All these things, they have very little value, if anything. What's the point? What am I doing? Why? But they believed in what their friends had said. And the friend had said, one day someone's going to walk up to you and they'll touch the coal. That is why they use the metaphor coal. Coal, because it has no value. I don't think it was literally coal. Something that has no value. So they took the friend's advice and stood in the marketplace with a stall, in a stall, having laid out all these things that were not of much value on a table. Kisa Gautami approached them. She looked at them. And then she looked at the things that these people, the two men, had brought along to sell. And then she looked at their faces again. And then she looked back at these items of very little value. She thought to herself, everyone else is selling things of great value. Some people selling food items. Others selling cutlery. Others selling pots and pans. Others selling jewelry. But this man and his son, which seems to be, they seem to be selling things of very little value. I wonder why. Kisa Gautami thought to herself, it must be because they are very poor. This is all they could find. They must be hungry. For them to take these things and walk up to the market and lay them out and expect for someone to come and buy them, they must be hopeless and most certainly helpless. If this is what their stall looks like, I can only imagine what their hearts must look like now. Kisa Gautami is thinking to herself, this man, this must be his son. They must be feeling terrible right now. Some great disaster must have come their way. And perhaps they lost everything. And now he has nothing to feed his family. So he has come to the market to try and sell whatever it is he has. Just as much as these things have little value, he probably feels that he is of little value right now. His son, who stands next to him, he probably feels, my father is of little value right now. Our family are of little value right now. And Kisa Gautami thinks to herself, seeing them like they are, I can't walk away. Seeing this poor man and his son in the state that they're in, I can't walk away. I can't look away. I had a similar upbringing. Kisa Gautami thinks to herself. As a young child, I didn't realize why my friends mocked me. But as I grew up, I realized I was ugly. And so my friends used to call me names. They used to call me Kisa. My name is Gautami, but they used to call me Kisa. That was a mockery. And I felt terrible in those times when they used to do that. I had a heart of gold, but they turned it into coal. But today, I'm able to stand up to all that. And I realize that real value is not in one's looks, but in the way that one conducts oneself. So I realize that the real gold is in my heart. Today, I see these two men. They must feel terrible right now. Today, their hearts, they feel, are cold. I must touch them. My words must touch them. And I want to turn coal into gold. And that is what she did. She spoke to the man. She spoke to his son. She spoke to them and said, Dear sir, don't despair. Difficult times come to all of us. I can see you're here today. I know you're a rich merchant. Normally I see you with a lot of valuable goods, and yet today you're here with this. Don't fear, sir. Don't you worry. These times will pass. Believe in yourself. Whatever you lost, you'll be able to earn twice, three times as much. All you have to do is believe in yourself. Work hard. You can do it. Don't worry. What did she do then? She turned coal into gold. And you wonder how Kisa Gautami went on to become an Arahant? That day, she turned two hearts of coal to two hearts of gold. She turned the frown upside down. That's the kind of stuff Arahants are made of. Then and there she was altruistic, because she gave up herself. She probably had to talk about herself. She probably had to talk about herself in a very self-deprecating way, of how she had some really tough times, of her tough upbringing, of how her friends mocked her, of how her family disowned her. And when she talked about herself to a couple of strangers, she reserved nothing. She gave up herself, knowing that with every word I say, these two people, they're going to feel better. I can't have them walk back home the way they walked here into the market. And that's what she did. She gave up herself for others. That's the kind of stuff Arahants are made of. So understand the flow in the system. That's what I've tried to explain to you today. Whenever you practice altruism, whenever it is others before oneself, whenever you give without keeping for oneself, it could be something to eat, it could be an item of clothing. Remember, once I asked you to clear out your cupboards, your wardrobes. Give away everything you don't need. You may have accumulated a lot. Over the years you have been working and collecting them. And then after you've done everything, remember I asked you to open your wardrobe and find the one item of clothing that you like and love the best. And give that away. What happens when you do that? At home, feed everyone else before you. Feed yourself. Whatever you have. Give it to others. I'd like even for you to think of the things, think about the things you have in this way. The reason you have managed to acquire the things you have is so that you could give them away. That is why you have them in the first place. Destiny or what other powers there may be have brought the things that you own, that you possess today, to you only so that you could give them away. And give. And they don't just have to be material things. Of course you know this. Give your time. Lend a ear. Lend a hand. Lend some soft-spoken, kind words. Do you remember the story I shared with you about the taxi driver a long time ago? Do you remember how the taxi drivers go the extra mile? Do you remember how when they see that you're pulling a long face, when they see that you are having a tough day, when they see that you may be getting up to some trouble or some mischief, they'll make it their duty to lend a ear, lend a hand, lend a heart. How many lives do you think they have saved? How many suicides do you think they have stopped from happening? Well, guess what? We have managed to compile some of those scenes and pull a video together, a video clip, which you will be able to watch today at the end of this sermon. Of how the taxi drivers, and that's just a very small part of the grand scheme of things I'm talking to you about right now. It's just one type of person, taxi driver. How they're doing what they can to help others. How they put others ahead of oneself. If a taxi driver can do that, folks, think about what you can do. Think about where you are in society, what you hold in society, the authority you hold in your organizations, the power and respect that you're able to command in the society that you live in today. Just think about how much good you can do to others. Are you doing everything you can? As a teacher, do you think your only duty is to teach the students in your classroom? As a teacher, how much do you know? Look at all the things you know today. Look at all the great skills that you've picked up along the way to becoming a teacher. Ask yourself, why has destiny bestowed upon me these skills, these talents, this knowledge? Everything you have is something for you to give away. That is why you have them in the first place. Everything you know is something for you to teach someone else. That is why you know them in the first place. Every skill, every talent that you have is one to help others with. That is why you have those talents and skills in the first place. You exist for the benefit of others. You exist for the good of others. You exist to turn coal into gold. Make that the motor of your life. Self before others. You have no idea how powerful altruism is. You have no idea how much I'm struggling to get these words out to you in the fullest meaning that I intend for them to reach you. I'm failing for words here. I hope you're having a better chance understanding what I'm trying to express to you. It is the start of all good, all things good, and it is the start of all things great. Altruism. Put others before oneself. Learn so you can teach others. Pick up so you can give others. Acquire so you can share with others. Build so you can let others have them. Live so you can help others. That's altruism. Be here so you can let others be. And it's not just doing it because it sounds good and nice and lovely. It really is the start of the end of this journey. It is the flaw in the system. This almost perfect system breaks at the point you engage in altruism. It starts to shatter. It cannot tolerate it because it is not designed in that way. That is the flaw in the system. This whole universe, it breaks at that point. That is why those who have become that way, those who have practiced in that way, where are they today? Are they in the system? Are they anywhere to be seen? How did they escape the system? How did they get out of the game? How come the arahants are nowhere to be seen today? How come when an arahant passes away, no matter what you do and no matter how hard you try, not even a Buddha can answer the question, they have passed away, where did they go? Where is their next place of incarnation? Not even a Buddha can answer that question because they have broken away from the system. How did they start that? How did they practice that? What did they perfect? They perfected the art of altruism. That's the moral of the story. You may not have understood any of the technical details. You may not have understood all of the stuff that I tried to explain to you. But hey, who cares? Put all that to a side. You don't need to understand the workings under the bonnet to drive a car. All you need is a pedal and a foot to go on it. That's simple. That's the simple stuff. So do that. You're not a nurse, you're not a doctor, just to help the patients that have come to you looking for your help. The things you have learned along the way to becoming one, the qualities you have picked up along the way to becoming one, the kindness in your heart that you have gathered on your way to becoming one, all that, share it among others Show others what their potential is. Show others what they're capable of. When you see people hiding in their own caves that they have built for themselves, show them that there's a bigger world outside. Little caves that they have built for themselves. Help them grow. Help them reach their fullest potential. Now, of course, you can take this in a worldly sense. It is applicable in that sense too. But I also mean it in a much more sublime sense. Always help those who are bad to become good. Help those who are good to become great. Make that your purpose of existence. Altruism is the name of the game. Once you have discovered that, the system can no longer keep you sealed in it. And that is why I'm sharing that lesson with you today. A lesson that my teachers have shared with me. Always put others before oneself. Always put others before yourself. In your attempt and efforts to help others, worry not that you have to sacrifice a part of you. That is exactly what you need to be doing. That's why. So I want you to think about those words and meant to you today. Simple things to do. If you just take a moment to look at the way you conduct yourself in the course of a day, in the course of a week, I'm sure, folks, I promise you, I'm sure you'll find at least a handful of ways in which you can be more altruistic than you are today. I'm sure you can. I promise you, you can. Just take a moment and think about the things that you do on a regular basis. How you can give others before you think about yourself. As I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be material things. It's not necessarily money or wealth. What about all the other things, the soft things, which doesn't cost anything, but are priceless at the same time? As I said, a kind word, a smile, a helping hand. A listening ear that you can give. You will have to sacrifice some of your time. So be it. That's a bit of self-sacrifice. Make time in your day to do that. If you're struggling for time, in the things that you do, be more like that. I'm sure you'll find ways to do this. All you have to do is just think about it. Because whatever the mind wants to do, the mind will find a way to do it. As Das Hamru said recently, if there's a will, there's a way. That's a lesson that Mahaprajapati Gautami taught us. If there's a will, there's a way. So make the will, and you will find the way. Okay, so think about that. Altruism is the name of the game. The more you do that, the more you will understand the Dhamma. Because the merit that you acquire in the acts of altruism are so incredibly powerful. I tell you, you have no idea. They are so incredibly powerful. Come up with a motto for yourself. Make altruism, the theme of altruism, part of it. You'll be glad you did. Make sure you watch the video clip at the end of this sermon. And I have also some news for you, which I'm sure you'll be pleased to hear. The stories of the great elders and the great elder nuns that Vasahandru has been ever so kindly relating to all of us over the last several weeks. We have managed to pull them together into one playlist on our YouTube channel, and you can access that through the playlist. I think we'll manage to get a link to the playlist into the description of this video on YouTube. So share that with your friends, especially young children. Remember, the reason we started this was because we want you to find role models. We want our young children, our young generation, to find new role models. Not the cardboard heroes of today, but real men and women who graced the surface of this earth. A long time ago it may be, but that era has again returned to us. It is time for great men and women to set foot on this earth again. It is that time again. It is time for the Aryans to wake up. The earth will tremble. It will indeed one day again. As 100,000 arahants bless the surface of this earth with their footsteps, that will most certainly happen again. I know that, we know that, because we are fighting for that. You know that because you are also fighting for that. We are all fighting for that. Because we know today the kind of stuff that arahants are made of. So restless, relentless, we strive to instill within ourselves that stuff, the beautiful stuff, the kind of stuff that can turn coal to gold. So let's do that. So that playlist is available on YouTube. It will have almost all of the sermons that Vasahandru has been doing over the last several weeks. So you'll have a good number there. And it's also a nice journey to follow them from start. As Vasahandru preaches those sermons, and of course you can imagine he'll take a lot from them. As he grows from a Samanera to a Bhikkhu, and one day to a great Arahant. It's his journey of transformation. Just as much as these sermons are the journey of a transformation that happens in the mind of the Swaminarayanse who delivers them. So we lay the path, and we want you to follow in that path. We want you to follow in those footsteps. Because this is not just an oasis that is in the desert that is reserved for me and my fellow monks and anagarikas and anagarikas. This is an oasis for all of you. This is the oasis that the Buddha established for all of us, for all sentient beings. Everyone is welcome. And everyone is encouraged. So it's up to you, whatever extent to which you can exert yourself and do the fullest that you can. That's all we ask of you. Do the best you can. Don't worry about what you can't. Don't worry about what you didn't manage to understand from today's sermon. I'm sure there was at least one thing that you understood very well from this sermon. Do that. And share those sermons with with friends, particularly those with young children, because they will be able to understand that. They may not understand anicca, dukkha and anatta, but they will understand the story of Kisa Gautami. They will understand the story of Patachara. They will understand the story of the great elder Mahamoggallan. Of course they will. And then they'll want to be like them. Wouldn't you want that for your daughter? Wouldn't you want that for your son? To be a man one day, to be a woman one day, whose footsteps, a single footstep, is a blessing on this planet, is a blessing on this entire universe. That is what this effort is for. That is what we are trying to do here. That is what we ask you to join with us to do. And it is for that you extend your support. There is many a heart that is weeping and needs to be comforted. There is many an eye that is shedding tears. Those tears need to be wiped. There's many a frown that needs to be turned upside down. It's time for you and I to do our part. Come and join us. Do the best you can. So, from here forward, Dasahandru's sermons will be available via the playlist, including the one that you may have expected today. So it is also available on the playlist. So have a look in there, and it will go live soon after this sermon comes to an end. And you can watch it from there. And then share it with others. As I said, particularly with young children, because they need a role model. When they're young and at home, you were able to be their role model. But perhaps today, they have grown into teenagers. Perhaps today they spend little time with you and time outside with friends and others. So perhaps today you are able to influence them less than you used to. But that is no excuse that you as a parent can give. My child got wasted after the first 15 years of his or her life is not an excuse that as a mother you can offer. That's not an excuse you can offer. We want to help you so that you don't have to end up offering such excuses. And this is the way we want to help you with that. Among the other things that we work on. So make sure that you listen to the sermon yourself and also share it with others. And as I said, it's available via a separate playlist. The great elders of our times. Before I conclude, I want to share one of the comments, one or two other comments that have come through, because I did ask, what I really wanted to do was to give you an avenue to share your experiences, your thoughts with us, because I realized that when you get that opportunity to share what you used to when you came to the monastery, and you used to come and speak to the Swami and say at the end of the sermon, I realized that that opportunity really gave you something to think about, and also really gave you a connection with the monastery. And the reason I'm keen on you maintaining that connection is because, you know, it's a bit like when we know that someone's watching, we think twice about doing anything that may be wrong or bad or evil, right? So always to always have that watchful eye is a strength to have. It's a real support to have. And I want you to feel that you always have the blessing and the overseeing of the Mahasangha with you. So that is why I wanted to give you an avenue to share your thoughts with us. I'll read out one story from one of our listeners. Several have come through. Quite a few have come through, and over the following sermons, I'll share as many of them with you as possible. And remember, the reason I'm sharing these stories with you is because I want them to be words of encouragement to you, to all of you. I want you to realize that there are people who are actually doing the things that we have been asking to do. And there will be men and women and children among yourselves. And it's always nice to hear from someone just like yourself, because those words are very powerful and very encouraging, aren't they? Perhaps sometimes if a Swami Mahansa asks you to do something, you may feel a little bit reserved. Maybe because you may feel, well, it's easy for Swami Mahansa to say, but, you know, I live a lay life, how can I do some of the things you say, Swami Mahansa? With all due respect, you might feel. But when you hear those words from someone who is your equal, one of your peers, it's much easier to understand them, and it's much more difficult to deny that you can also do it. So this is why I want to share these stories with you. So here's one. Therwan Sarnai Garu Swami Mahansa. Last Sunday's sermon made me feel more connected to the Mahasangha at the Arame, and more precisely connected to the Dhamma. When we had to stop coming to the Arame due to the pandemic, I felt more and more connected. The workload allied with visiting the Arame was cut down, like arranging things at home, preparing for the visit. And this time also I used and occupied to listen and practice the Dhamma. During this difficult time of the pandemic, I have managed to add lots of positive things into my life. It has enhanced me and helped me to walk this path consciously. My life has been streamlined for my ultimate goal. I always chant the Dhirasa Gathas, and I always think of myself to be very fortunate. While doing the Aryamaitri meditation every day, focusing on the Aramya, I felt very much connected, like a strong string going from me to the Aramya, and that I felt we are connected. This happened when we stopped coming there. In fact, I wanted to share this thought with Swami Mahansa. I feel this is because I get the same blessings from my Dhamma teachers, and it's a two-way communication. I'm happy, and I get a lot of encouragement from Swami Mahansa's words. It'll keep us bound forever until I reach my goal. During the last few months, I was fortunate to find the ways and means that encouraged me to purify my mind and walk this path. I think every morning how fortunate the sun is to have seen all the Budhun Mahansas, so all the Buddhas and all the Arhatun Mahansas, all the leaders of other great religions come into this world, and then and the sun nourished all those great people. The sun also got all their vibes. Then I pay my respect to the sun every morning. So I think this person does this as they chant the Dhirasa Vigata Mohasa Gathas, as Guru Amaravasa used to do. I worship with great respect, and I receive good health in return. Sudhu Minisu gave me a great impact. I have also managed to add some good practices to my daily life and routines. Those days I just did whatever came to my mind, but now it always gets screened by the Dhamma. That's exactly what I have wanted you to do all this time, so well done. So I think this is my improvement. I know this particular mind has to be qualified to become an Arhant, so I'm protecting my mind and looking after it very carefully, trying to nourish it with only good thoughts. It is our Swami Mahansa's Dhamma, which has encouraged me on this path. I was able to give smiles to a few lives through Dhamma, Sadhu Sadhu. Myself together with my children, so my son, we walked about 2 kilometers the other day and took the Daval Dhani, so the afternoon meal, to the priests in our village temple. So I think this is given the fact that there are curfews and various restrictions on travel. Perhaps they were not allowed to drive there, so they've managed to take the Dhani to the monks and have walked 2 kilometers. So like, look at, you know, this is exactly the stuff I'm talking about, folks. Thinking about others and not about oneself. You know, when there's a field, an unequal field, that can be sowed with the seed of merit, why reserve yourself? You know, whether that's 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers is not the question here. It is the fact that it's, even if it means that I have to make some additional effort, even if it means that I'm going to be sweating and panting by the end of this journey, if the Swami Nuhans is in the village temple, are needing of a meal, and I am able to make it with my own hands and take it to them, then I will do so. And what a great mother to have accompanied her son along with her on this great meritorious deed. It gave me lots of insights by offering this dhani. All this advice have come to me through the monastery sermons, and they have helped me to widen my thinking patterns. We are so blessed to have Dharmayabai, the Dhamma, in our lives. May the Triple Gem bless you all. May all these merits contribute to attainment of arahathood by all our Swami Nuhanses and the Anagarikas at the monastery and in the near future. So that was one of the comments that had come through by one of you. I don't know who, but it's come through some of you, one of you. That's one example of, you know, this is the kind of stuff I really want you to be able to put into your life, folks. Right? This is what I'm expecting you to be able to do. Not that taking dhani into the monastery or temple every day, but how your life has changed as a result of the Dhamma, how the way you think about life has begun to change, how you face problems and how you face adversities and the atrocities that come your way, how you face them in a very different manner, how you have managed to put smiles, add smiles to people's lives. That's the kind of stuff that I'm looking for. I'll read another one for today. Therun Sadnai, we are undoubtedly grateful for giving us an opportunity to share the progress made consequent to receiving the erudite exposition of the Lord Buddha's teachings every Sunday for almost 2 years. The ambience at the Arame, enlivened by your, I'll read it as it is, I think they're saying, by your majestic deliverance, impacted in us firmly. I'm sure you mean the Buddhas. That experience is now history, but the live discourses continue to maintain the momentum, more so because we are mindful that our life's journey is in the horizon. We have, during these past years, divested all our static encumbrances with the support of our children, except for the accoutrements that are necessary to sustain ourselves and retain a simplistic lifestyle. Our greatest joy is that two of our children, who had the privilege of listening to your sermons during short visits to Sri Lanka, continue to listen and practice in their adopted countries. More importantly, share these noble teachings with associates excuse me, who are in search of the truth. We have also shared with our friends overseas who have benefited from these sermons. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What a great example. Once you have received something, this is, you know, this is where we started, right? I started talking to you about inviting the devas, inviting others who may not have still been able to witness the advent of a Buddha, others who may still not be aware to the fact that the Buddha's Dhamma prevails. Once you've got the best of something, why do we always have something? I explained to you a moment ago. Why do you have something? Why do you get something? Why do you receive something? It's always to give away. And that's exactly what, I think this is a gentleman and his wife, possibly, what this couple have managed to do. To share it with their children, with others, with friends. And that's exemplary. We have attempted to share very briefly the status quo of our life's journey. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem bestow you with energy to enlighten many more sentient beings to attain the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. And same goes to you too. Right, so a couple of examples there of the testimonials that have come, that have been coming. And I'll keep that avenue open for those of you who like to share those thoughts. There are quite a few more, particularly those who have taken great efforts to really list out in bulleted lists. These are some of the 5, the 6, the 10, 15 things that I have managed to take from these sermons over the last couple of years. Having read them, I thought that was incredible. Incredible how people have managed to do that. And that's why I said, you know, isn't this, I expect nothing less than this. Remember the last, in one of the sermons I said, I feel so connected to you all through the Dhamma, and it must be because you must be doing the things that we have been asking you to do. Well, you have disproved it. So, now you know why I felt that way. Okay? So, please do continue to do them, and remember, altruism is the name of the game. Okay, so, on that note, we will transfer the merits and conclude the sermon. The story of the Arahatan Mahanse for today will be available on the separate playlist. So please look out for that and listen to that as well and share it with others when you get an opportunity to do so. Okay. So let us take a moment then to transfer the merits we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting Pirit, listening to the Dhamma, and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. So first and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasakas, and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand, and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that among them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Swami Mahanse and all other monks resident at this monastery, as well as the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits and express our gratitude to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them, and may through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May through the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deed, fulfill the meritorious deed, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits that we have acquired to our devotees, friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone, from those of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery, to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who have passed on their know-how and extend their well wishes. May through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deed, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our mothers, fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, cousins, our elders, and various other relations, friends and acquaintances, employers and employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us, assisted us, particularly in our difficult times, in any way, shape or form. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas, Brahma, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakkadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Sambuddha Shasane. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May through the power of these merits they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all who have been our families, friends and acquaintances in this infinitely long journey in samsara, and who have helped us, supported us, assisted us in every way, shape or form they could. Let us transfer these merits to them. Let us also transfer merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who have sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe, rejoice in these merits, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer the merits to all those who have lost their lives in the natural calamities such as the tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, and also in the prevalent pandemic, particularly those who have given up their time to help and support men and women and children who have been affected in these difficult times and continue to do that selflessly, reminding ourselves that among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey in samsara. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to them. May through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in woeful planes, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds. May they fulfill the meritorious deeds. May they fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, let us all resolve that may through the power of the merits and the power of the blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahatun mahanses on this blessed land once again. And finally, may through the power of all these merits we have acquired today, you and I and everyone who has helped me make this program a success, become an arahatun mahanse and arahat mehinin mahanse in this very life and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the noble triple gem be with you all. We will now conclude the sermon. May the blessings of the noble triple gem be with you. You know sometimes how we hire people to do things for us? It could be anything. Say, just catching a taxi. Right? Simple as that. Most all of you will have used a taxi at some point in your life. So catching a taxi. Now, when you get a taxi, you get into the car and you ask the taxi driver to get you from point A to point B. And what the driver would do is he'd reset the meter, and then off he goes. You're in the car, and then at the end of the journey, he will stop the meter, work out how much you owe the taxi driver, and you will make your payment, and off you go. So in very simple terms, that's the end-to-end process. So some taxi drivers follow that to the letter. They'll ask you to pop into the car. They'll ask you, where would you like to go, sir? And they'll take your instruction. And then off he goes. So he'll drive you to your destination. He'll work out the amount of money you owe him. And he says, and that's a total of X amount of money, dollars, pounds, whatever, rupees, and you make the bill, he says, thank you, and off you go. Now that's the normal process, the happy part if you like. Then you have some taxi drivers who go the extra mile. So some drivers will go the extra mile and may even try to cheer you up. You can't tell me you've never had that experience. Right, so there are some great taxi drivers out there. Three-wheel drivers, right? When I say taxis, I mean all sorts of taxis. right? And they will do what they can to bring happiness into your life. Great people. Great people. So you are paying them to get you from A to B. But what about the words that they're saying to cheer you up? It might be that you've had a long day at work. It might be that you've just had some bad news. Lost in the family, or perhaps been dumped. Some bad news, some terrible news, and you're pulling a long face, or you're teary-eyed, and or you've your chin in your hands and you're looking out the window, staring into the openness. And the taxi driver's thinking to himself, "Gosh, this man seems to be having a really bad day today. Let's see if I can cheer him up." So then the taxi driver might start to try to have a conversation with you. You see, he'll try to have a conversation with you, not knowing how you might react. Beautiful human beings, aren't they? Your next words might be, "Can you just shut up? I just need to concentrate." Or, "Just do your job." No, taxi drivers get abused a lot of the time. And they won't say anything. They just keep quiet and they'll go and they'll do their job. But for someone to feel that I want to do something on top, I want to go the extra mile, I want to do more than what he's asking me to do, that's a sign of greatness. So he might start to chat to you and say, "Sir, what's up? What's wrong? You seem like you've had a long day today. Is everything all right, sir? Anything's the trouble? Anything bothering you?" Or he might even, just say, "Oh, it's rainy weather today, isn't it?" Just to get you into conversation. Just to cheer you up. Just to put a smile on your face. You've all had that experience, I'm sure. So to them, you getting into their taxi and paying them whatever amount of money that you're going to owe them at the end of the journey is enough for them to feed themselves. But they feel that they have a duty to you. As I said, beautiful mind, beautiful hearts. You need to observe these things, folks. If you see these things within people, that's when you're beginning to, or you have already broken back. You need to begin to spot these qualities within people. Greatness. Signs of greatness. They're infectious, I tell you. And then they'll start to talk to you. Sometimes they'll very slowly but gradually enter into the, bring you into the, into a, they'll try to build confidence. Sometimes they might even share an experience that they had in the hope that what they're trying to share with you is worse than what you have in your mind that's bothering you. And when you listen to that story, you're going to wonder, scratching your head, thinking, "Gosh, I thought I was having a bad day." See, they're sharing their most intimate details with you. Not because they just want to have a chin wag. It's because they want to cheer you up. They're going the extra mile. And they won't stop until they've turned the frown upside down. Sometimes they might even compliment. "You're looking very smart today, sir." That's all you need even, to turn that frown upside down. That's the only compliment you got all day. If you've never been there, get into a taxi, I tell you. There are some beautiful hearts out there. One day, someday. Because we can help them go from good to great. Beautiful hearts. How many people do you think might have gotten into a taxi thinking, "I'm going to take this taxi, go and get to a bridge and jump off the bridge"? How many taxi drivers do you think have saved people's lives? See, unsung heroes these people are. Unsung heroes. No one talks about them. Oh, but these things happen. How many three-wheel drivers do you think have saved people's lives? Perhaps they got into the taxi, they were fuming. They were on their way to someone who had wronged them. Maybe with a weapon in their hand. Saying, get me to that place as soon as you possibly can. I'm going to tear him a new page. I'm going to blow his brains out. Might have been some of the words that would have been said. But what did the three-wheel driver do? Mister, take it easy. I'll take you there, don't worry. Just take it easy. Come on, you know, things happen to everybody. We all have problems. Let me tell you, something happened to me lately. And then he will share with you an intimate story that happened to him. He's never said it with anybody, but he'll share it with you in the hope that you begin to realize that you're not the only one who's got problems in your lives. And then that has cured you now. At the end of that journey, you'll go, you know what? Just take me back home. He'll take you back home, and then he'll say, it's on me. That trip was on me. Go home. Have a good time. Keep safe. There are so many beautiful hearts out there. My question to you is, how much do they charge you for it? Does the meter on the taxi go up with every word they say? With every word that comes out of their mouth to heal your festering wound that is your mind? The fire that is burning within, with every bucket of water they throw at you to put out that fire, does that put up the meter? It does nothing to the meter. So really, at the end of the journey, when you ask, what is the bill, all they're going to account for is the amount of miles that you have, that the wheels of the vehicle has traveled. It'll only account for the time that you have spent together. But what he has done for you, in the time that he has spent with you, that is priceless. Priceless. If he were to charge you for that, believe you me, you wouldn't be able to pay the bill. You'd go bankrupt. My question to you is that, how do you pay that debt? Do you have enough money for that? If you were to draw out all the money in all the accounts that you have, is that enough money to pay all those debts? The debt that you owe him for saving your life? The debt that you owe him for saving you from getting into a fight? The debt that you owe him from saving you from getting into some brawl or some kind of altercation and causing harm and damage or just a broken heart? How are you going to pay that? Not everything in this world can be counted in rupees and cents. Not everything in this world can be accounted for in pennies and pounds or cents and dollars. You can't do that. Because the beauty that lives in people's hearts, that is priceless.